I'd like to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Nate Downey. He's a local landscape designer. He's author of the book Harvest the Rain. He's a columnist for the Santa Fe New Mexican. Welcome, Nate, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
It's great to be here, too. And I always like to do some gardening and landscape shows when the weather gets nice and people are full on into gardening. And even if they're not, they're thinking about it and wishing they were doing it. And this year's been kind of an interesting year because I guess it was dry winter, wet spring, dry summer with occasional outbursts like we had a day or two ago.
We're still getting lucky. It's gotten hot and warm and dry, but who knows? I think this is going to still be a good year.
So how do you handle the sort of crazy fluctuation and unpredictability of New Mexico weather?
Well, you want to be prepared for every storm. If you own your own home or if you just want to take care of a piece of property, you want to make sure that the water coming off your roof isn't running off and taking all your soil away. You want to make sure that it's sinking into your soil and getting to the root zones of things that you plant that then provide shade, that might provide some beauty, some food, a windbreak, and maybe some privacy or noise prevention. And so I see the water coming off of our roofs and our roads and our driveways as a wasted resource. And so these spring rains have been so incredible. We have a lot of water going into cisterns in this town and many projects I've designed and installed. And it was so wonderful to use that water on edible plants and not have to use city water up until very recently.
What do you do with the rain that falls on your roof? I mean, assuming your it doesn't just like puddle on your flat roof and eventually leak into your house, which is a place that I've been on more than one occasion.
Yes, we get those calls this time of year after a big rain, and there are so many localized and intense storms. You never know where they're going to be, but you head on out there, and people who've been living in their homes for 20 years suddenly realize they have a grading problem and a drainage issue at the foundation of their house. And often those are pretty easy to fix, but sometimes it can be very tough given geology or property line issues. But the basic answer to your question is you harvest that rain, and it's either passive harvesting or active harvesting. Passive harvesting stores water in the soil, and you don't have any moving parts. And so it's usually something that most people can afford.
So meaning it runs off your roof into gutters, and then out of the gutter you attach like a system to water your yard?
A system might be a little bit of a glorified term. It's essentially grading, and that's the easiest way to get going and to make sure that your slope is conducive to allowing water to soak into it rather than run off it. And so we install what are called rain gardens or on-contour swales where the water can percolate into a skinny temporary pond that just fills up for a few hours perhaps after a rain and then soaks into the soil. So you don't lose very much to evaporation and you get a lot of water soaking into the soil and building soil.
So instead of like a rain barrel, you'd have a little kind of mini pond?
Well, yes, rain barrels can be helpful, and they can also be not so helpful because on a 1,000-square-foot roof, and that might be a little bit more than the typical rain barrel would be servicing, but just for mathematical purposes, 1,000 square feet of roof in Santa Fe, a 50-gallon rain barrel will overflow 132 times. So you want to think about the water overflowing out of a typical rain barrel unless you're really clairvoyant and you can get out there and remove the water in the rain barrel before the next rain comes, which is also sometimes hard to do because it just rained, and why would you want to use up that water in case it doesn't rain? So I'm not against rain barrels, but I've seen a lot of situations where in this climate they're not as helpful as you think they, as one thinks they might be. If you're going to store water in any kind of vessel, it's better to make it a little bit larger so that if you have a pump, you have a pump that's able to be used more often than the 50 gallons of water stored, and then not much after that. And because what happens is so much water will just overflow out of a rain barrel. So then we're talking about active water harvesting, which does have moving parts. You typically have a pump or a pump house and a pressure tank so that you can get the right amount of pressure to a drip irrigation system, which is a very efficient way to water plants in the desert. Of course, water from a roof is actually very clean. There's a little bit of filtration that has to occur, but it can even be used for drinking water. And a lot of people up in Rio Mesa and other parts of the state and the world survive very well on what is really some of the cleanest water around.
Besides maybe a little bird dropping here and there?
Yes, you do have to run it through if you're going to drink it in the state of New Mexico, you have to run it through a system that has a UV light in it, and that basically burns anything that would be dangerous.
How do you get the soil in your yard, in your garden, to absorb water instead of having it run off?
It's partly that contouring, and that's the quick and easiest way to do it.
What does that mean?
That on-contour swaling that we talked about, that rain gardens, that carving your land so that water can soak into it rather than be sloped and steep and run off. So it's essentially making little pockets or pores in the soil where the water can soak in. But there are better ways to do it and more productive ways to do it. They require a little bit more thought and a little bit more installation cost, but
or elbow grease,
elbow grease, and some materials cost as well. There is something I've been doing for 20 something years in town called a pumice wick, and that's a sponge underground. So water comes off the roof, it goes into a little drain box, and out a pipe, a 4-inch pipe. And wherever you'd like to grow things, you have a trench filled with pumice, and you run a perforated pipe in that pumice and cover it up with a thick layer of newspaper and then soil so you don't see this thing, and you plant on either side, and the roots from the plants will suckle right up to that wick and thrive. However, pumice is a nasty thing to mine, and it's not very good for our watersheds. So if the ultimate goal is ecology, the better product to use is a recycled glass product. It was developed here in Santa Fe, invented and developed here in Santa Fe, and they moved down to Albuquerque's recycle center and their dump, and they make this pumice, man-made pumice product called Growstone, and I've been using that for 3 or 4 years now instead of pumice and feeling really good about it.
That's so interesting. I love it when the synthetic is better than the natural.
Yes, it is. It still requires a heating process to heat the glass up, and then they blow foam into it to allow it. It doesn't look like glass anymore. It's just this very lightweight gravel, essentially. And so there's this industrial process associated with it and a carbon footprint. But when we're already, especially in Santa Fe and other places where it's sometimes hard to get the glass that we recycle to any kind of market, it's nice to have something to use our recycled glass in, and then considering what we're doing with it, which is typically growing trees or food or windbreaks or beauty, privacy screening, it's really worth it. And no moving parts and no evaporation from stormwater, which you would typically get in that contouring or that rain garden.
We're talking to landscape designer Nate Downey. Now, you were saying a moment ago that there's a lot of wasted water. And, okay, so if I figure out where the water's coming through the roof, from the roof, make sure it goes down a gutter, that gutter goes into either a little homemade pond, which we dig out, or we contour the land so that it makes a kind of a shallow puddle, shall we say.
Yes.
Okay, so that's the first thing. But what about driveways? I mean, a driveway is a driveway. In fact, I got really wet in my neighbor's driveway yesterday because there were big puddles of water that's just going to evaporate. What's to be done?
That's a good question. If you can slope your driveway so that it can direct water to a particular place, then it's often very similar to what you would do with a roof or a downspout or a canali. You can do that same contouring and even those grow stone wicks. But
wait a minute, but that means getting the asphalt person to come over.
Right. If that's
saying,
not
make a slope on the already existing asphalt.
If you don't have the power over your neighbor's driveway, then, or your own driveway, then, and sometimes it's just impossible physically to slope it. What's used is permeable pavement, which is becoming more and more popular. So rather than having puddles, you have this pavement that diverts water into a system that can gravity direct water to some other place. That's also an expense that people have to incur, and it's not always feasible for most people, but it is a potentially growing part of my market.
Do people ever just, like, drill holes in their driveway so that the... Because I was thinking, I was looking at the driveway. There's these beautiful ponderosa pine trees that aren't getting enough water because there's driveway there and their roots are under the driveway. Can you, like, punch holes in the asphalt?
I was picturing a gravel driveway, and I would say, yes, you could. Just drill... And then fill it with gravel and actually perhaps a weed barrier fabric around the gravel so it doesn't fill up with silt too quickly. And that would work. In terms of the asphalt and drilling holes in the asphalt, I think that would just cause more problems for you in the future as the asphalt begins to break more quickly, and then you need to patch up the asphalt, and that's a stinky project.
Right, right. So there are so many ways of thinking about water here in the Southwest in the high desert, and there are all kinds of other water besides the water that falls from the sky and the water that goes through the city water system or from your well that a lot of people use to irrigate. I have a little irrigation system now and turn it on, and it, you know, I'm basically watering with drinking water, but everybody is. But what about other kinds of water? Gray water, black water, wastewater, all
yes.
those kinds of things.
Well, fortunately, and for the last 12 years, the state of New Mexico has had a law that allows people to use their gray water on their landscape or even in a compost pile without a special permit, as long as they follow certain guidelines. And what's really surprising to most people is that gray water does not... require and should not be used in association with any kind of pump, and it shouldn't be stored in a tank. It should go right out into what we call a mulched basin, which is similar to that rain garden or that contouring or that on-contour swale that we were talking about earlier, except for you really don't want to mix your gray water with the water coming off of your roof in a major storm event.
Why not?
It will... Potentially, if that should overflow, the gray water will then essentially pollute the stormwater. So you want to control your gray water mulched basins and not allow runoff from somewhere else to get into those basins.
Gray water is water that comes out of your shower, basically?
That's one of the places. Good question. It's everything but the toilet and the kitchen sink. And when we say kitchen sink, we also mean dishwasher. So don't connect all that gunky water, that's what we would call sewage or black water. But you can take water from your laundry, your clothes washer, your bathroom sink, and your shower and your tub.
If you do that, do you have to use like organic or natural soaps and detergents and things like
yes,
that?
Yes, you do have to be careful not to use bleach in your washer. That's probably the biggest thing that can happen. Bath salts are an issue. And most soaps actually are not going to cause problems. If you're cleaning paintbrushes in the bathroom sink, you definitely want to have a valve that you can sort of reach down or crawl under and turn and ensure that water will go the regular way, and then you can go and pollute the city system. But it would kill plant material, those basics that I think most people understand. There's lots of labeling that's going on, and a lot of it does say gray water safe. It is a little bit hard to really track down. I think brands that you can buy at a natural food store would be fine. But do watch out for bath salts. That would just, over time, be a problem.
Yeah, salting your garden really is not the very best idea.
That's what we're stuck with already. The bottom of an ocean here, as we once were millennia ago.
If you have a house that doesn't have a gray water system, how hard is it to put one in?
It's hard in many cases because most of our architecture here is slab on grade. There's no crawl spaces and no basements. If you're building a house and you're going to have slab on grade, you can create a dual plumbing system, essentially, that will work fine for those purposes. But if you're going to change an existing house, it's really best to have a crawl space or a basement, which many people don't have in this neck of the woods.
Yeah.
With one exception, the laundry machine is often very accessible. Even though it's on a slab, the water that comes out of a washer is high up, and since we're going to be using gravity, we're going to be able to access it, especially if it's on an outside wall. We can access that water and use all of your laundry water outside. But if you're on a slab on grade, gray water is not typically an option.
When you are looking at the systems that exist in Santa Fe, are people able to water their whole entire garden from their gray water and not use irrigation?
No, not typically. Most of, at least our clients, want to do a little bit more than that. But it's certainly possible to create a little oasis with your gray water and water some native trees and shrubs and or even edible plants, as long as those tomatoes or leaves of lettuce and such are kept from the water itself, you're allowed to, and it's safe to, use that water on edibles, as long as that water doesn't touch the actual thing that you're going to eat.
All of this seems just so complicated.
Oh, does it? I'm trying to make it as simple as
I can.
No,
not complicated conceptually, but like if you were trying to do it yourself, you've got to keep this water away from that water, you've got to keep that water away from your lettuce. And it's really, I mean, I guess it's second nature to you because you've been doing it for so long. But when you think about, I mean, we're trying to achieve sustainability here.
Yes.
And you come home from work at 5 or 6 or 7 o'clock and you're tinkering with your yard. It's hard.
We are, I think, in a pretty interesting place in terms of our culture. We've actually, in the last 10 years, really come to accept the local food movement. Permaculture is now a word that we don't typically have to define, although just for those out there, it's a synonym for sustainability. But we're still in the infancy of getting back to the land, essentially, and it really happened after World War II. The industrial agriculture industry really took off, and people, there will put a stigma, and there was a stigma, on farming. And so now that stigma has begun to go away, but there's still this industrial agricultural system that makes food very inexpensive compared to someone who's going to try to grow things in their backyard and sell them. So we're in the infancy, I think, of a revolution here, and it's perhaps never going to change back to something as, say, as primitive, if you will, as it was. But I think we can do much more by interviews like this and books like Harvest the Rain and teachings of permaculture classes that go on all over the world. And if anyone Googles permaculture in their local Santa Fe or wherever you're listening to this program, you'll find that there's other practitioners who will be happy to teach you. And it is complex from a standpoint of, look at all this information that I have to learn. But it's not complex from the standpoint of a philosophical understanding of sort of what we have to do, which is mimic nature. And so when we mimic nature, when we mimic the patterns of nature, we're doing something that is actually second nature to us. And we can be extremely powerful and extremely effective, extremely productive when we look to things like the branching pattern that we use in our gray water systems and in our cistern systems, in our drip irrigation systems. Well, the best way to think about a drip irrigation system is it's really just a a branching pattern that goes out, and just as a tree would want to be very efficient with its branches, you would want to be very efficient with your materials and actually follow a branching pattern, for example. The spiral pattern of nature is found everywhere in tornadoes and in waves and the shellfish. And the spiral pattern turns out to be a pattern that you can put to your advantage as well in your landscape. You can build an herb spiral so that all of your herbs are within reach, within arm's length of you. And the spiral is mimicked such that the plants that like the most amount of sun and the least amount of moisture, the herbs, would be on the top. And the plants that require a little bit more moisture would be on the bottom. And it's a 3D spiral, so the top is elevated. And it spirals down to a low point on the north side, where that's where you have your mint. And the top is where you would have your sage. And the microclimates that are created by these plants help each other and work with each other in a very positive and productive way. You can bring in with your parsley, say, the umbelliferae will bring in ladybugs, which will keep your aphids down. And so as soon as we start accepting the fact that nature's language is something that we've basically forgotten and that we can easily relearn, then we become more efficient and more productive in our own backyards.
There's also the issue of bees and the great decline in bee populations. And I love it when I go to the nursery and there's plants that have bees on them. I think, oh, those are the plants that I want because they're going to keep the bees around.
Yes, that is very important. The whole bee thing is something I've tried, and I've had some hives and not been all that successful. They do take some work. It's like having a pet. You have to take it really seriously. And the best beekeepers are out there a couple times a month and checking on them and harvesting honey and just keeping things sort of in order to help the bees be productive and making sure they're getting insulation sort of covered in the winter and sometimes food in the winter is very important part of beekeeping. And there's a large movement in town that's been going on for quite some time, and we're very lucky that people have gotten so excited about bees. And it's very horrifying when we think about the greater bee population, and who knows, there's various theories, but it seems to point to pesticides that are they're killing the bees. And so we have this very productive monoculture system where it can be very efficient in terms of our dollars spent. But the costs are never considered when you buy an industrial tomato. What that tomato has done to the environment.
Yeah, what it's done to the bees. And I wasn't even talking about beekeeping. I was just talking about, I mean, I don't even know where the bees in my yard live. But they hang out there, and that makes me happy because they're pollinating and they're alive and they've got a place to go.
Good. And a lot of people are actually afraid of bees, and I would say that they are so interesting and so fascinating, and that was probably the best thing about the beekeeping that I did do, was to have almost a relationship with one of the oddest species on the planet.
Bees?
It's as if, I think it's the closest thing we have to alien life forms. It's
just what do you
considering
mean?
How productive and effective they are, they don't, to our way of being, they really make very little sense. And the beekeepers who have done it the most will say that they knew the most about beekeeping in the first couple years of doing it. And then it's like philosophy. The more you know, the more you realize you don't know. And so I highly recommend it, and the occasional bee sting is worth it.
We're talking to landscape designer Nate Downey. Now, what about on a community level dealing with water? What are some of the things that are going on, for example, on the level of the Santa Fe River.
Mm-hmm.
What is so great about having a running river besides the fact that it just looks wonderful?
Right. Well, we can bring in biodiversity and native plants. We used to have a river here. The river is the reason Santa Fe is here. And what happened was a number of things, including the building of some reservoirs that we then hold back that water and use it when we need it. Also, the extermination of the beaver prevented water from soaking in deeper, and so we allow our water very often to run off rather than being held back by beaver dams. But one of the most important aspects of a relatively dry, and this isn't a good year to say that the Santa Fe River is a dry river, but typically it is, and we'll talk about in a minute why it's wet right now, but the cause of our essentially arroyo that the Santa Fe River has become is in many ways urbanization, and that's the roofs and the roads and the parking lots and the patios and the sidewalks and all the impervious surfaces that come with an urban watershed. And rather than having rainstorms that allow water to soak in and gradually migrate toward the river, we have rain events that are very effective at getting water out and through the river very quickly. And in the process of that, they dump a lot of sediment into the river, which also makes it difficult for the river to be a river. It fills it up with dirt, essentially. So if we create this porosity, these rain gardens and this contouring, these growstone wicks, where water off of our roofs and roads and driveways actually soaks into the soil, we'll have a better chance of having a living river, because ultimately much of that water will migrate and pop up in all sorts of places where it used to pop up and into the river. Right now, we have so much water in the river for simply one reason. We had a construction project going on. If we had, even with all the rains that we've had, we would most likely have just a little trickle going through the Santa Fe River at the moment. But the construction project was very important, and we had to basically let our largest reservoir open, and so that water comes through, and that's why we're not holding it back. And so the construction project, I believe, won't be finished until the end of this year, but next year we will have to hold back the water in McClure Reservoir, and no longer will we have such a lovely experience of the Santa Fe River.
What could the city do, for example, you're talking about all these impervious surfaces, to make a critical mass of those surfaces porous, or make the roads like all this, you drive down Cerrillos Road during a rainstorm and you feel like you're in, Florida during a, yeah, right. So, how could that water be used in such a way that, for example, the Santa Fe River sees some of that water?
It will take some time. And it will take some vision and some leadership. And I do think we have that vision and leadership in City Hall right now. And my view is that water projects are a great way to create the jobs for young people that we're kind of always looking for in this town. And the question always is, where can we get the money to do these water projects? Whether we do public work and get Youth Works and Earth Care International out there building check dams and other structures in the arroyos and right off of parking lots and the rain gardens throughout town. I mean, it's going to take a long time, and it will take a fair amount of money. That is a start, but you could also incentivize homeowners the way we had the toilet retrofit program. We could probably also have a rain garden retrofit or a canale retrofit. I don't know what the word would be, but some kind of program where you get a little rebate for doing something with your canale that prevents the pollution that every canale or downspout creates in a big rain event with erosion, with the sediment that comes through that ends up ultimately in the Santa Fe River. Why not take that problem and use it in a positive way, create some more root material, root mass in the soil that then holds the slopes back and prevents the pollution and creates shade, beauty, food, windbreaks, etc.
And on top of that, it sequesters carbon.
That's correct. Very important from a climate change standpoint. And that shade is very important from a climate change standpoint as well. When you can shade the soil, you'll have less heat coming off of urban areas. And we all know where you want to park at Home Depot. It's by the tree.
Right.
And so we could have a lot more trees if we look at our parking lots as resources.
One of the really memorable people that I talked to on this program, and it was years ago now, but I've never forgotten it. I've kept thinking about it. Was an artist who answered a call for proposals for a city in California that wanted to do a wastewater treatment plant, and she designed a wetland that was both beautiful, she was an artist, and was a wetland with all the scientific properties of a wetland so that sewage flowed into it, and essentially clean water flowed out, and it became a destination for migratory birds, and it was this beautiful thing, and it didn't smell bad, and it was self-sustaining because plants kept growing and things like that. Now, this was in a moist climate in California. Are things like that feasible in a desert climate?
Oh, absolutely. We're all using water, and we have wastewater, and we talked briefly about gray water, but what you're talking about is using, you know, not separating out that gray water and using gray water and black water together in a wetlands, in a constructed wetlands. And absolutely, Santa Fe has a company called Biohabitats, which focuses, I believe, on black water systems and constructed wetlands, and they work all over the country and the world, but they have successful systems here as well. I know that it does take at least 12, 15, maybe 20 homes to make the work sort of economically sensible. But when you have a critical mass of, say, a neighborhood or a development with enough homes that can direct all of their wastewater to a particular place, yes, you're talking about huge quality of life increases and improvements and excellent use of wastewater. Rather than creating pollution downstream, you're creating biodiversity and a beautiful and productive place just down the road.
Could you do that for a whole entire city? I mean, not just a neighborhood or a development.
Absolutely. The cities in Northern California, I know, have been very successful, and they sounded a lot like the Women's Art Project that you just described. They were forced, because of the Clean Water Act back in the 70s, to create a concrete structure at the end of town that would have been ugly and fenced off and stinky, and the people kind of rose up and said, we don't necessarily have to do it this way. And so I believe 9 ponds end up filtering the wastewater for the city and becomes a beautiful bike path, walking trails, wildlife habitat. They didn't have to do anything to have all the migratory birds and other species show up. And then, of course, the tourists show up because it's a nice place at the end of town rather than a sort of a concrete, fenced-off, stinky place.
Well, and it's amazing. The tourists show up and the hikers and bikers show up for basically the sewage zone.
Yes, and few people really even realize what's going on.
Right.
It's just a nice park at the end of town.
Nate Downey, what are some kind of tips and practices, maybe pretty simple and low tech, that people can use to make the most of their gardens this summer?
Well, the most important thing that gardeners in the Southwest have to consider is mulch and what type of mulch is best for your situation. And there's lots of materials for mulch. There's shredded bark, there's gravel, there's straw, there's pecan shells, and my favorite mulching is a mixture of a few materials, and it's a sheet mulch where you start with a layer of cardboard, corrugated cardboard. Worms love the glue of the cardboard.
No way.
They do. And mycelium, which are essentially the roots of mushrooms, like to use that air that the corrugation creates, and they'll spread. But on top of the cardboard, you put a layer of fresh manure, horse manure is relatively available down on Alameda, and a lot of horse farms and places that board horses will gladly give you, or for a very low price, provide you with horse manure. And take it out and spread it on that layer of cardboard, and then on top of that, a layer of straw. So you take a straw bale, and the straw bale is made up of 30 or so slices. We call them books or flakes. And you take that book or flake and you disintegrate it somewhat, but keep it still as one piece, and place it on top of the 2 to 3, 4 inches of manure that you've laid on top of the cardboard. And then you let that sit for a period of months.
Now, this sounds like something you might do in the fall.
It could be done. The worst time to do it is right before you plant, because you do need a little bit of time to digest. If you're going to do some fall planting, doing it now would make some sense. You don't want the fresh manure that I encourage you to get to be too hot and burn the roots of the plants. And you also want the cardboard to decompose, because it'll act as a weed barrier initially, and actually for a long time after that, because of the layer of manure and straw. But you do need some time for that cardboard to break down. So when it's time to plant, and this is not a good system for any kind of seeding or sowing any seed, you need to have a plant in a little pot or a large 5-gallon, whatever, and spread out the straw and the manure. And if you've given it a few months and there's been some moisture from rain or snow events, that cardboard will have broken down. And below that, you'll have some really amazing soil. You'll probably find some worms. And so you spread that straw out and you push what's left of the manure, and it'll look a lot like compost. And you really won't see much more of the cardboard. Dig a hole and plant your plant, and then push the mulch back. And it's amazing how the benefits of any mulch will really make the soil healthier. You'll be harvesting moisture and preventing it from rolling off your property. You'll be shading the soil, which prevents evaporation of moisture from the soil. You'll be insulating the soil in the winter and the summer, and you'll be preventing weeds, and you'll be building microorganism colonies, and the ultimate result is a much more absorbent soil. And so whatever you plant in that sheet mulch is going to thrive with very little help.
Nate Downey is a local landscape designer. He's author of the book Harvest the Rain. He's a columnist in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. Your column is, Sunday? No.
Every month.
Every month.
And it's called Permaculture in Practice, and sometimes it's in the home section, and sometimes it's in the regular real estate section.
And Nate's website is permadesign.com. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.